Welcome back, everyone. Am I on? Yes. Please have a seat if you're still coming in. Today, we have presentations from the Connecting Cluster, Disciplinarities, Valuing Nature, and Technosphere / Coevolution. I'm going to be very brief. I will just say a few words about each one and then introduce our first presenter. So the Disciplinarities seminar is really about the question of how do we know things. In this world, in the Anthropocene, we have many kinds of knowledge that have to come together in different ways. We also have many things that we know we don't know, and we have other things that we don't know we don't know. So what are those and how can they come together? What are the multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary clusters of knowledge and ignorance through which we must think in the present moment? Our second seminar is Valuing Nature. This is really about the question of what nature is worth and how we can know that, what it does for us, how we should we begin to see it as a form of capital that we are spending at an alarming rate? I think often in that respect about the fact that in many parts of the world we are now mining fossil water. We have run out of water that is recharged at the surface, and we are drilling deeper and deeper to strata of water that are millions of years old and pulling them to the surface. So the Valuing Nature is about ethical value, about economic value, and about epistemic value. The third and final seminar in this set is Technosphere / Coevolution. This is building an analogy between the biosphere, which has been a way of collecting, transforming, and storing energy and matter for billions of years, and the technosphere that we have built, which does the same thing, collects, stores, transforms, and uses energy and matter. In the technosphere, we have the combination of individuals who can think and know things, and institutions which also can know things and act, but not in the same way. And often problems of collective action are about institutional movement as much as they are about individuals. So with that, I'll introduce our first presenter, Bronislav Cherchinsky. He is the head of the Department of Sociology at Lancaster University in the UK. He is concerned with understanding changing relations between people, the environment, and technology. He draws on social theory, qualitative sociological research, philosophy, and theology. He's been focusing especially on climate change and geoengineering, the eco-capitalist imaginary, urban ethical foodscapes, and decision-making in an unstable world. And he was just telling me about his forays into philosophy of the air. I think we won't be hearing about that this morning, but Bronislav, please come forward.
So I'll explain why I'm calling this talk Holding Up the Sky later. Hopefully it'll become clear anyway. So this is the introductory talk to the Disciplinarities seminar, as Paul said, that I'm presenting with Mark Lawrence, Wolfgang Schaffner, and also Thilo Wiertz. So Paul gave a very good introduction to it, really. It is about sort of knowing the Anthropocene, but also knowing in the Anthropocene. You know, is there something about the Anthropocene that challenges the way we think about knowledge? So the most obvious answer to that, well, of course, you know, we need all the disciplines to come together, and that's exactly what's happening in this campus. But in a way, in this talk, I want to try and see if I can push that notion as far as I can. So push that notion that we need to think differently about knowledge. And maybe even by the end of the talk, I'm not even sure I'll be talking about knowledge at all. That's how far I'm going to try to push it. And I'll see if I can take you with me. And I'll just start with this quote from Timothy Morton that some of you might know. So he suggested in an essay, when he was thinking about, is the Anthropocene somehow the end of the world, some kind of apocalyptic event? And he suggested that maybe it is the beginning of the end of the world, not as a decisive apocalypse, but as the opening of a far more uncanny historicity in which humans realize we are living on after the end of the world, by which he means the end of a coherent text. So where concepts such as nature, world, life world, Weltanschauung, world picture, etc., start to lose their coherence to us. And so he suggested, following Jacques Derrida, as it were, paraphrasing Jacques Derrida, that maybe a good translation of the Anthropocene is there is no outside human text, that somehow the boundary or the relationship, if you like, between the human as knower and the world as known, that kind of relationship and distinction is being troubled, or at least we're becoming more aware of how it was always unstable and our concepts of knowledge were maybe more problematic than we thought. So some sort of obvious ways of the sort of things we might be trying to bring together in a way that Paul mentioned before would be the different disciplines and the different kind of mega disciplines of natural sciences, social sciences, humanities and the arts. And I'm sure in our seminar we will talk about how we bring together those different forms of knowledge, which kinds of knowledge we need to bring together and why and how. But also, I think we'll also talk about different kinds of knowledge, the encoded knowledges, which all of those disciplines in some sense are engaged in, knowledge that can be written down, that can be codified, that is disciplined in that kind of sense of discipline, but also embodied knowledge, knowledge which we know through doing things and we can't necessarily articulate into words, or perhaps forms of embedded knowledge which are distributed across, that aren't just held in the heads of individuals or in the bodies of books and texts and papers, but are somehow distributed across systems of humans and objects and technologies and so on, such as the climate knowledge, which Paul writes so well about, a kind of form of embedded knowledge. But we might also want to talk about the difference between Western knowledge and non-Western knowledges. Now, of course, that's a problematic distinction which we can worry at, but let's sort of leave it there for now. As Helmut Trischler said yesterday, you know, we need to bring in non-Western views. You know, the Anthropocene discourse so far has been very, very Western. But I think we have to ask, what does it mean to engage with non-Western knowledges and non-Western worldviews seriously? And particularly, not just non-Western epistemologies, if you like, forms of knowing and representations and cultures, but also non-Western ontologies, understandings of the world and of being and so on. So in our seminar, we'll be taking a particular case study to work through these issues around knowledge, which is something that a few of us have worked on, which is geoengineering or climate engineering. So here is the kind of a classic diagram from the geoengineering literature of the sort of technologies which are imagined to work through chemistry or physical processes to reduce global warming by various means, reflecting sunlight or absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere and so on. So we'll be talking about that. But for this talk, what I understood we were asked to do in these opening talks was to take a particular case to illustrate some of the issues that we are going to look at in our seminar. So the case I chose to take was that is that of the, it's a big, very big case. It's a whole civilization. But to us, it might seem rather remote and specific. And that's a Yanomami of northern Brazil and Venezuela. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this was to try and sort of challenge, to see whether we can use it to sort of challenge this sort of Western bias of the Anthropocene discourse that we're all sort of starting to worry about. And one concept we can use here is that of white mythology. Now, this is an essay by Jacques Derrida, and it's a rather nice concept. So Derrida said, you know, what is metaphysics? He said, he described it as a white mythology which assembles and reflects Western culture. The white man takes his own mythology, that is Indo-European mythology, for the universal form of that which is still his inescapable desire to call reason. Now, to call Anthropocene a white mythology, you know, this is a very tweetable kind of moment, I suppose. You could easily collapse this into 142 characters, even with a few hashtags after it. And it's quite easy to be derisory about it. And of course, I'm deeply fond myself of the earth sciences and the kind of understandings they're giving us of the deep time of the earth and so on. But I think Derrida is saying something quite precise here. By metaphysics here, he's referring to a particular kind of way of thinking that he sees as dominating in the West, which prioritizes presence rather than absence, purity rather than mixture, the kind of simplifiable rather than the contingent and the complicated, and seeing anything else as a sort of aberration away from that. And so a kind of form of metaphysics which splits the world into dualisms and then puts them in a hierarchy where one is primary and the second is derivative. And of course, Derrida is famous for trying to say, no, we need to realize that these dualisms are always interpenetrating and undermining each other. And so I think the Anthropocene plays very well into that kind of critique of Western metaphysics. And by mythology as well, we can mean something quite specific, just like he does by metaphysics. And I'll return to that when I'm talking about the Yanomami, because I think thinking about the Anthropocene as our mythology is not necessary to say it is not true. It is more to ask what kind of truth it is and whether we can use Amerindian thought to rethink what our mythology is to us. Okay, so this is a kind of a classic diagram of the deep time of geochronology. Now, one of the points that Derrida is making when he talks about white mythology, he's also talking about the whiteness of the page. So when you see, you know, like when I'm holding this up and it's got black writing on the page, we can see the writing and we take the page for granted. We don't see the page. His point is that the page which our mythology is written on, the kind of presuppositions, the assumptions, the ground, is itself a form of writing. It's itself very specific, very culturally specific. And so, you know, we have to try to use other forms of knowledge which don't necessarily aren't necessarily very easily combined with our forms of knowledge to try and make it more visible to us what the presuppositions are, the kind of background of that image, if you like, which we take for granted, that makes it seem possible and seem true. Okay. Just going back to this diagram, it's interesting that... I'll skip over that. I haven't got time. Okay, so the Yanomami... So one important thing to remember, of course, about non-Western cultures is for them, in a sense, you know, the apocalypse has already happened, particularly ones, you know, who in the Latin American context who have experienced colonization, contact by whites and so on. So they have a kind of a different kind of chronology of that. But they also have a different view of time. They don't necessarily... see time as simply laid out along a sort of single linear calendar, but they can see time, different forms of time, the time of spirits, the times that shamans can enter, as somehow overlaying each other in different kind of dimensions. And they can also have a very different view of knowledge. So let me just say something about the Yanomami. So these are Amerindian people, about 35,000 of them, that occupy this border territory between Brazil and Venezuela. They live in about 200 to 250 villages in these large communal huts with family units all living together. And they live through hunting, gathering, and also certain forms of gardening. They have a kind of horticulture and so on. But since about the 1970s, their territory has been invaded, if you like, by Garimpeiros, who are independent gold diggers who are trying to get at the mineral wealth that are on their territory. And they've been affected by this. And I just want to show a short film clip, sorry for the quality, it's on YouTube, which illustrates some of the things that's been happening to them. Okay, so if we can have the film now, thanks.
For thousands of years, Yanomami children like these grew up in their rainforest home facing few real dangers. Then, 5 years ago, all that changed. Their safety ended when outsiders discovered the vast riches of their rainforest.
The Yanomami would still be safe today if it wasn't for this, gold. A tiny amount like this is worth £25. Miners can come out of the jungle with bags full. It's the promise of riches like that that have brought them here in their thousands, and it's killing the Yanomami.
As they search for their fortune, the miners break up the soft Amazon earth with powerful jets of water, scarring the forest forever. A year ago, there were five times more gold diggers than Indians in the Yanomami homeland, and miners hunting with guns killed so many animals that many of the Yanomami began to go hungry. To separate the precious gold from the mud in their pans, the miners use mercury, a deadly metal that's poisoning the rivers. Downstream, there used to be much more fish than the Yanomami could ever want. Because the rivers are poisoned now, the fish are dying, and another source of food has gone for many Yanomami. Now, when they go fishing, they often catch nothing at all. And the Yanomami have to use the same polluted water for washing and drinking. Until the miners came, the rivers had been unspoiled and pure. These Yanomami are fairly healthy, but many others are ill or dying from diseases the miners have brought into the jungle.
Great, thanks. So that's the sort of account of some of the more recent experience of the Yanomami through contact with Westerners. Okay. So, but now I want to talk about the Yanomami cosmology. So the Yanomami believe in these two kind of demiurges. They are gods. So Amama is their god. They take their name, the Yanomama. Yanomami is named after Amama, who is the sort of demiurge who didn't create the whole universe but created the earth that they live in, the forest and the sky and so on. And Yoasi on the left there is Amama's evil brother. So whereas Amama wants everything to live forever, Yoasi brought death into the world. In Yanomami belief, Amama created the sun because the sun always shines. Yoasi creates the moon, which waxes and wanes and is a symbol of death. The Yanomami cosmos is also full of many non-human beings. There's a general kind of category of Yai Thepe, which means invisible non-human beings, which includes the Shapiri or shamanic spirits, who are the images, Now, this is an interesting word, that the way that they use images, the images of the primordial, mythological animal ancestors of the Yanomami. Also, there are the spectres of the dead, there are various malefic beings, and there are also, of course, the animals as well, which they have complex relationships with. And an important role in Yanomami culture is that of the shaman, who inhale the yakawana powder. It's extracted from a bark of a tree, and it enables them to communicate with the shapiri spirits, and also to change their form into animals and so on. So it's a kind of form of communication, not of the mind, not just of the mind, but of the body as well. Now, the richest account of the Yanomami world has probably come from this long collaboration between this shaman, Davy Kopanawa, and the anthropologist Bruce Albert. And this has just been published in this book, The Falling Sky, which is now translated into English, Portuguese, French, now English. And in effect, I read this book as the Yanomami version of the Anthropocene, and I just want to take you through it. So the Yanomami cosmos is in the is in a number of layers. So at the top is this kind of the first sky, the sky that's up there. Now, this is the sky above the sky that we see, and it's something very ethereal that the Yanomami don't talk much about that. Below that is the sky that we see. Now, you can see underneath the sky. So we live here on this third layer, which is called this layer in Yanomami. This is where the Yanomami live, the forest. What they can see above them is the chest of the sky. So you imagine the sky is crouched over them, the chest of the sky, and that's where the sun and the moon and the stars are. And on the back of the sky live various of these shapiri spirits and also the ancestors of the dead and so on. Now, this forest here, where the Yanomami live, is actually the back of an old sky that fell down and crushed the original forest. So the original forest is down here. It's kind of like a hell figure, if you like. And so the original human inhabitants of this forest were pushed under the ground and turned into these kind of carnivorous creatures because of lack of food and everything. So the Yanomami live here, as we do when we invade their territory. And one of their great roles, if you like, of the shamans, is to keep doing the rituals to make sure that the sky, this sky up here, doesn't fall down and crush them like the first sky fell and crushed the people below them. So, enter the Shawariri. So that, according to Kopanawa, all the oil and the metals which white people seek under the ground are the remains of that earlier sky that fell down and created the forest. So the metals, if you like, were the skeleton of this first sky that fell. And when it fell down, Omama, the good god, buried this metal under the ground because he knew it was dangerous to protect the Yanomami. But then the white people who didn't understand that come and they take up the metal and the oil and they make their goods and merchandise and they bring them to the Yanomami. And when they open the boxes and show their machetes and their plastic bottles and things like that, and their cotton, the Yanomami could smell these smells and see this sort of dust coming up out of the chests, and they could say, why can't the white people smell this strange smoke? And the smoke brings the Shawariri, which are these cannibal spirits which enter into the chests, make people ill, so that the Yanomami started to die, their children started to die, but also the white people are affected by it as well. So part of the shaman's role has become that of trying to deflect away the Shawara epidemic of these cannibal spirits. So Kopanawa said, this is why we also sometimes refer to white people as Yoasi Theri. That's people of Yoasi, the evil brother of Omama, We see their merchandise machines and the epidemics they constantly bring us death as traces of Umama's bad brother. And so this is the Shawara attacking a human here. And so they also see their role, as I said, of holding up the original sky, the sky that's there, and so that they don't suffer what the original inhabitants of the first forest suffer. So it's a kind of continual climate engineering, in a sense. Okay, so I want to use this case to illustrate some of the profound questions about knowledge that the Anthropocene raises. So firstly, how should we think about these radically different forms of knowledge from Western scientific knowledge on the one hand and indigenous knowledge on the other, embedded in very different forms of life. And I want to just draw on some terms from this very nice paper by Andrew Barry et al. On logics of interdisciplinarity. So if we ask, what should the relation be between the Yanomami Shawara epidemic and the Western Anthropocene on the other? So one kind of hope we could have is some form of integration. This is the sort of high watermark of interdisciplinarity, that different knowledges could come together into some synthetic understanding of the world. Is this always possible? Is this always a good thing? You know, is this always the most productive way that knowledges can be brought together? Or is there a danger that one form of knowledge, one discipline or one worldview can become subordinated, can be made simply to plug itself into another form of knowledge? You know, so we could approach the Yanomami as bearers of traditional ecological knowledge, that they have knowledge about plants and biodiversity, which could be useful for, you know, Western pharmaceutical companies or biodiversity scientists, or they might have, you know, they do have experience of local climate change, ecological collapse, biodiversity loss. So could they, you know, be gathering information that could be fed into databases, etc., and so on and so forth? But or is that merely to subordinate their worldview to the Western worldview? Or, to use another term from Barry et al., would it be more productive to really start to feel the clash, the agonism, the struggle between these two different ways of looking at the world? So this, again, to use a term from Barry et al., would this enable us to think about how knowledges could be brought together, not just for the sake of innovation or the production of new disciplinary knowledge in the academy, but to reconceive the objects that we're thinking about and also the relationships between the subjects and objects in the field we're talking about. And I just want to finish by suggesting one way that I think the Yanomami can do this for us, to help us reconceive the object of research and the way we think about ourselves as subjects doing that. And this is this idea of perspectivism, which was developed as an understanding of the Amerindian worldview by the anthropologist Eduardo Viveiros de Castro from Brazil. So he is describing perspectivism not just as his anthropological worldview, but as the shared worldview of Amerindian culture. So whereas in the West we tend to think there is one nature and many cultures, so the problem is how we can harmonize or bring together our representations of the one world that we inhabit. Viveiros de Castro suggests that Amerindians think that all beings share one culture, they all see the world the same way, but they inhabit many natures. So all beings perceive the world in the same way, But what is different is the world they see. So all beings perceive themselves as human. So the jaguar or the tapir, they understand them, they think of themselves as human, because human is simply the mode of experience of being a subject. So they experience themselves as human, and they experience other things as predator or as prey. But what makes them different is the different bodies they have and the different kind of corporeal, affectual desires. So what a jaguar will experience as drinking beer will be perceived by a human as it drinking the blood of the animal that it's caught. So underlying this whole ontology is this idea of an original state before the cosmology, before the beginning of time, if you like, of non-differentiation, where all beings were the same. Basically, all beings were human in a sense. And animals have somehow, for us, lost that ability to be human. So whereas in the West we think of humans as ex-animals, the Yanomami think of animals as ex-humans, but the animals still see themselves as humans. And shamans are those people who can still retain that original state of undifferentiation, where the body can be taken off like a piece of clothing and they can change the state into that of an animal or that of a spirit and so on and so forth. So that's quite a lot to take in. So what would that mean if we kind of try to bring that home to our own white mythology of the Anthropocene? Would it make us, for example, think differently about the way we parcel off the time, the deep time of the Earth, to imagine, that the Carboniferous era or even the Precambrian era are still over, all that these monsters here, all these strange non-human beings that we populate this diagram are gone, and these different sort of tectonic forces of the early Earth or of the great oxygenation events and so on are somehow in the past and are not still operative in the present. Other ways of thinking about time in a more Yanomami way to suggest that undifferentiated moment in time that we place, way back there in the sort of cosmic cloud out of which the Earth cohered, but the Yanomami think is still operative behind the time that we experience in the everyday. Is there some way that we can, reactivate that sense that the deep time of the Earth is still operating now? And I think that's a real challenge for us. But I think to bring the Yanomami worldview and ours into a kind of generative clash and to confront us with... to make us think about the whiteness of the page on which we write our science and make us realise that it is itself constructed and specific, I think might be a useful exercise. And I'll finish there. Thank you.